All rise. The Chief Judge and the judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and the Honorable Court.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're here to hear the case for United States versus Tech Sergeant Wilson. Good morning, Mr. Spinner, Major Kerr, Major Daly, Colonel Christensen. Mr. Spinner, are you ready to argue?
Yes, ma'am.
I understand you're reserving 10 minutes, is that correct?
Correct.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, as you all know, I'm Frank Spinner, and together with Major Kerr, we represent the appellant, in this case, Sergeant Wilson. Now, the only issue that I'm arguing today is the first error sign, and the only, should I add, non-gross defined issue in the case, which is factual and legal sufficiency, and the focus of my argument will be on factual sufficiency. I note that the government filed in a case or two yesterday or the day before, and in any event, the one point that I do want to make is that we recognize under legal sufficiency, at least I recognize under legal sufficiency, that the testimony of a complainant alone can be sufficient to meet the legal sufficiency standard. My focus is on factual sufficiency at this court, however, because of the powers that you have under Article 66, but also because it is my view that the complainant's credibility is the key issue in the case, and in the absence of any corroborative evidence that she should not be believed beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the thrust of the focus of the remarks I'm going to make in the time that I have today will be directed at her credibility. What's interesting about this case is that there were mixed findings. Sergeant Wilson was charged with three different charges, but with respect to the specifications, they were mixed findings. And so of approximately, I think it was nine or so specifications, he was acquitted of everything but three specifications. And I come into this very sober. As I look at the court before me, I recognize all of you have extensive experience in military justice, experience as defense attorneys, as trial counsel, as trial judges, and for a lengthy period of time as appellate judges. So I come before this court somewhat humble, recognizing that all I can do is point out some things that I think are important for the court's consideration, but recognizing at the same time that there is no substitute for reading the transcript of the record of trial. I have spent many hours poring through this record of trial. I anticipate the court will have spent many hours reading through the record of trial. And obviously the focus of any reading of the record of trial would be with respect to the complainant's testimony and cross-examination, which covers almost 200 pages. And so the issues that you struggle with in performing your Article 66 duties are comparable to what the court member struggled with in this case. And the fact that they came back with mixed findings, I think, makes the challenge even more clear, because some of their findings, they acquitted Sergeant Wilson of a specification that occurred on the same day as another specification for which they convicted him. And I would just point specifically to specifications 1 and 2 of charge 3. Basically, the complainant testified about two different incidents, one involving the shower, touching that occurred in the shower, that was specification 1, and specification 2 was an allegation that Sergeant Wilson exposed himself to his stepdaughter. And they convicted him of one and acquitted him of the other. Another interesting part of this, and to be with all candor with the court, When you look at Charge 2, Specification 1, and Charge 3, Specification 6, as I read those two specifications, they really cover the same act. And so the reason for it being charged the way it is because of 1 October 2007, the new Article 120 came into effect. So the way they charged that was because they couldn't say for sure whether the specific act occurred within the month prior to 1 October or the month after. As I read it, that's why it's charged the way it is. By the way, Sergeant Wilson was acquitted of that specification. And then when you look at Charge 2, Specification 2, and Charge 1, those occurred in approximately the same time frame. Sergeant Wilson was convicted of Specification 2 of Charge 2, but he was acquitted of Charge 1 and the specification under.
Counsel, just for my clarification, Spec 1 of Charge 2 deals with October, and Spec 6 of Charge 3 deals with September.
Correct. 1 October 2007, the new Article 120 came into effect.
Right, I understand that.
So they're only alleging one act of misconduct, but I think the problem is because it's on or about, and so the issue was just that the law changed, but the act may have occurred between the beginning of September.
So you're saying the time frame, if we hadn't changed 120 and 134, it would have been September to October?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
But what's particularly interesting, too, is and as you look at this case and the facts underlying the claims made by the complainant, the offense of which he was, well, the two offenses, both the Charge 3, Specification 7, the obstruction of justice, he was acquitted of that, which was very close in time, obviously, to the charges. But also, in terms of the sexual misconduct, Charge 1 occurred. He was acquitted of it, but the claim was that it occurred just after or right around the Christmas time frame of 2007, 2008, and this case came to the OSI's attention in January of 2008. So Sergeant Wilson is acquitted by the members of those two specifications. And I think what is at the heart of the matter is a proof problem, but it's a credibility problem as well. This was a dysfunctional family. It appears when you read the testimony. Sergeant Wilson's wife testified. Of course, his stepdaughter testified. And this case is really different in terms of the obstruction of justice charge because the claim was that there was some collusion or some effort by Sergeant Wilson to convince his wife, to convince their stepdaughter to withdraw the charges. And ultimately, the government relies in their brief in part on Mrs. Wilson's testimony to corroborate her stepdaughter's testimony. And, of course, the problem is her own credibility is so much in question that I would submit that this court should not give weight or credibility to Mrs. Wilson's testimony in considering whether it corroborates anything that her daughter said. What I attempted to do is I went back through this record, and again, what I invite the court to do, this is a case where, quite simply, you can throw away my brief, throw away the government's brief, and just sit down and go through the record yourselves and see where the prior inconsistent statements are, see where, the cross-examination of the complainant is like a roadmap of prior inconsistent statements, motive to misrepresent, contradiction, inconsistency, even inconsistency in her own testimony during direct examination.
So basically you're saying we should do our job?
I'm saying Well, certainly I'm saying
I mean, isn't that, are we required to go through the record of trial and figure out legal and factual sufficiency?
Yes, it is, and never having been an appellate judge, and so I can only speculate on how these things are done. I assume that each judge on the panel reads, in a factual sufficiency case, the entire record. I can only assume that. But I speak from ignorance in that respect. I think that the defense counsel did a very good job in cross-examination, but one of the key points that I'm not sure I highlighted adequately in my own brief was the testimony of the school teacher. Because one of the questions that always comes up, and I'm referring specifically to Rosanna Cumberland, and her testimony begins at page 522 in the record. In defending any kind of child sex case, one of the questions is that I think is important is, how was the first report made? To whom was it made, and in what context was it made? And when you read Ms. Cumberland's testimony, what you see is that the complainant came to her and that her focus was not on saying, my daddy did this, or my stepdaddy did this, or whatever. Her focus was on, I'm unhappy. I'm unhappy with both my parents. I want to go live with my dad, even though it's clear that she had her natural father, even though it's clear that she had no real relationship with her natural father to speak of. And so you have to ask the question is, did she want to get away because she was being abused, or did she want to get away in a way to get away from her dad, who was the disciplinarian in the family, who was very strict, who took her cell phone, who restricted her computer usage? Did she want to get away from dad because mom and dad are fighting, dad's strict, mom's easier, and then she comes up with the idea, hey, I can just claim that my dad.
But she had also reported it to two of her school colleagues, one of whom said, if you don't tell the teacher, I will. Well, and as I recall the testimony of one of the school boys who testified, I think he said it was in Spanish class or something.
Right.
He seemed to recall, he said it was a quote, I don't know if it was an exact quote, but he said that the victim told him that my stepdad is feeling me up.
Right, and there are problems with his testimony and when the report was made. The defense cross-examined the complainant about when she told him about it, and they couldn't even nail it down whether it was before Christmas or after she came back after Christmas. So his statement said a few weeks ago, which would have put it after Christmas. She made contradictory statements as to whether it was before or after Christmas, and she said that he felt me up, or words to that effect, and that doesn't even appear on the charge sheet anywhere, that he felt her up. I mean, that one of the interesting things to me in his testimony and the statement that he made is this supposed report that she made to him did not correspond to any of the factual allegations.
Well,
in
I don't think those words you'd find in any model spec in the MCM, but I think the gist of it was that stepdad was doing something inappropriate.
Well, right. That's the gist of it, but it doesn't match up with what the government has put on the charge sheet. And in fact, if you look at specification 4 of charge 3, there is no specification 4. It was withdrawn and not referred to trial, and it had to do with feeling up. And so even the government wasn't even convinced that there was a credible claim that he was feeling her up. So if he was putting his hand down her pants, then why didn't she tell her friend he's putting his hand down my pants? I mean, the timing is there's contradiction as to when those statements were made, and to the extent that that may have been made at the same time that she went to the teacher, then I don't think that the court can put much stock in it. With respect to the other person that she purportedly told, he didn't testify in the trial. So we have her claim, and she's been proven not to be credible on other things, so we have her bare claim that she told this other friend, but he didn't testify. So there's no corroboration that she told the other friend. Now, there's sort of a second theory underlying the defense case. The second theory underlying their case had to do with, you know, were mom and daughter in collusion? In other words, what was a mom influencing the daughter or not? And the problem that you have from the defense side is that it's very hard to show why someone is lying. You can only infer or speculate as to why someone is either lying or is not being completely truthful. And so the problem that you have in this case, as you look at mom's testimony and as you look at the complainant's testimony, is just trying to figure out, okay, what really happened and when did it happen? So I would submit that the court members were right to find Sergeant Wilson not guilty of the obstruction of justice, but that further highlights the lack of credibility of Mrs. Wilson in this entire proceeding. The other thing is that when you look at the lack of detail, another point that the defense made, and I'm not sure what the court should do with this. I mean, I'm reluctant to even bring it up. But they did highlight in their cross-examination the fact that the complainant was unable to really give details to the OSI when the original interview took place. And that other details surfaced only after a judge advocate, I think it was a Captain Frank, got involved. And then all of a sudden these details start to emerge, but there's no statement. There's no written statement. The only written statement that the complainant made was in that initial statement to the OSI. And even with respect to that original statement to the OSI, Sergeant Wilson was convicted of Charge 2, Specification 2. And when she talked about that particular specification to the OSI, it sounded like she was saying that that occurred Saturday before the interview. And yet, the actual specification goes back to the October time frame. And in court, she testified that I think it occurred in October. It was an incident involving a computer where she wanted to do something with the computer. And so what you have here, and I'm really puzzled as to why the members found him guilty of this particular specification, because you would think if she sits down and makes a statement to the OSI and says this occurred on Saturday, and the fair inference is the Saturday just preceding, then why does she show up in court and testify that it occurred in October, the prior year? So I guess I want to focus, before I sit down and save the rest for a rebuttal, I want to focus on the fact that with respect to the complainant, whether you look at prior inconsistent statements, whether you look at motive to misrepresent, whether you look at memory, and that was a big factor in her case. Any kind of impeachment you want to look at, that impeachment existed in this case. And the government really, in their brief, they just seemed to fail to acknowledge that there was impeachment in this case that took place. They just recite her testimony as though it's the gospel and say, well, because she said it, therefore it must be true beyond a reasonable doubt. Furthermore, and I've seen this in other government briefs and factual and legal sufficiency arguments, there's this sort of tension between, well, what are you doing when you're deciding legal sufficiency and what are you doing when you're deciding factual sufficiency? And so therefore, I want to make clear that I recognize that you all did not have the opportunity to view the demeanor of the witnesses when they testified. I did not defend this case at trial, so I don't know what their demeanor was like. I certainly can't comment on the brief since I didn't see it. But I maintain, after 20-plus years of working at the appellate level, and I've made this argument in other appellate cases, so it's nothing new that I'm saying today that applies to this case, that the benefit that you have as appellate judges is you have the verbatim record in front of you. The members, when they go back in to deliberate, they really have to try to piece together their memory of what happened and vote on each of the specifications. And about three of these specifications, the complainant had described very similar activity. It was almost a cookie cutter in a way in how she describes it. But you have the benefit to be able to go back and cross-check. I mean, I even created my own cheat sheet. I'll show the government here. I had to try to sort out the different charges and specifications and set up a chronology when they occurred and to see which specifications overlapped with the others, because I couldn't keep track of what he was convicted of and what he was acquitted of. And so the problem when you have this kind of a record of trial and those number of specifications and comparable factual scenarios, the problem that you have is sorting out, okay, is she talking about 2005 or 2006? Is she talking about 2006 or 2007? And I think that's what made this case challenging for the court members, but also makes this case challenging for you all. Because if I'm assuming you're going to do your, I have every reason to believe you're going to do your duties conscientiously, and I see my time is up, if I may just finish the sentence.
You may.
And I know you will do it conscientiously, is that it really, for me, took a lot of work to write this brief. And so all I can ask the court to do is that same kind of detailed search of the record in performing your duties. Thank you.
Thank you. Major Daly.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Major Deanna Daly, and together with Colonel Don Christensen, I represent the United States in this matter. Contrary to what the appellant is arguing and his claim and what he's argued right now, there is ample evidence to find that the jury was correct in convicting the appellant of the three specifications beyond a reasonable doubt. First, the jury took notes, asked questions, over 25 questions during this trial. They were very attentive. Almost every witness they had questions for. Further, the government provided 5 witnesses to testify. And in fact, 2 of those witnesses were about previous statements before ELC had ever reported. The jury took 10 hours over a 2-day period to think about these charges. They listened to all the evidence and saw the demeanor of the witnesses. And that's very important because under U.S. v. Turner and Article 66, that's what you have to consider, is the benefit that they had, not the benefit, with all due respect, that you have, but the benefit they had. They were able to watch ELC testify over a 2-day period for 7.5 hours. As appellant has pointed out, over 200 pages of testimony. They watched her testify and answer questions. And then they went back and deliberated for almost 10 hours. And who knows why there's not guilty? That's not what we're here to decide, or what you're here to decide, why there was not guilty. But there is, it's factually sufficient evidence to sustain the 3 specifications that he was convicted of. Now, appellant argues that you should look at the time frames of each of these specifications. However, at the record at 300, during ELC's testimony, she begins to talk about actually 404B evidence, and there's a lot of, there's an Article 39A about the 404B evidence. And during this 39A session, it comes out that there are a lot more instances that weren't on the charge sheet that happened, and that the government, after cross-examination, wanted to go into that 404B evidence. However, the military judge was, in effect, said, you can go into what is in her first OSI statement and then what's on the charge sheet, but you can't go into other instances that weren't on the charge sheet. And what is that indicative of? This is indicative of a 15-year-old girl who's on a stand for 7.5 hours answering questions by the government and defense. and she is trying to explain each of these in detail, when in fact it happened numerous times. And luckily you, the court, has the ability to look at that 39A session and see that there were in fact numerous instances that weren't testified about. However, that explained some of her memory or her recollection, and that it wasn't perfect.
Counsel, I want to draw your attention to Specification 5 of Charge 3.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which involves the touching her legs with his hands. Apparently, you concede that there's no evidence that he touched her leg with his hands. Is that correct?
Your Honor, we acknowledge that during the testimony, what ELC testified to is that he walked up behind her in the bathroom in his uniform, pulled down her pants, and was touching her vagina area. During that testimony, she said he went in between her legs and then specifically asked, did he touch your legs? She said no. So the government does acknowledge what she testified to relating to that specification.
And then you ask us to accept out that language and substitute other language. Do we have the authority to do that?
Yes, you do, Your Honor, under Article 66. And I have a case where you have done that. It's actually United States v. Hong, and it was one of the two cases that I submitted in a supplemental cite, motion for supplemental cites, to authority. And in that case, it was based on a drug case where the accused or appellant used drugs on that.
We should be feeling much cooler momentarily.
That makes me happy, sir. Anyway, in U.S. v. Hong, it was a drug case that was here at the court, and what happened is he was convicted of on diverse occasions of possession of cocaine. But during appeal, it was proven that he did not possess that cocaine at different time periods during the charged time frame. He actually just kept possession of the cocaine the whole entire time. And so what this court decided is that they could accept the words on diverse occasions. And because when you did that, it didn't change the sentencing landscape. The maximum punishment did not change. And the crux of the charge of the drug possession didn't change. You've modified the findings and then reassessed the sentence as the same as the military judge adjudged at the court, and then approved the findings and sentence.
Well, I guess my question is, do we have the authority to substitute, which is what you're asking us to do in this brief?
Right. And, Your Honor, during the government's point or position on that is changed, and we believe now that you have the authority to accept the language in touching.
We can accept but not substitute?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And that's your position at this point, contrary to what was written in the brief a while ago?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And
I just want to be clear. You all, the government is admitting or conceding that at least part of that specification is legally insufficient.
We're conceding that the testimony, we're conceding that she did not testify that he touched her legs.
Okay.
She was talking specifically about the specification.
So, and what's the government's position of the impact on that?
We think that it's a technical, not substantive impact, because the gravamen of the offense does not change. And touching her legs, if you take that out, you still have pulling down her pants and underwear with the intent to gratify. And looking at that testimony, if you look at the totality of those circumstances, where he walks up behind her and pulls down her pants when she's facing the sink and starts to rub her pubic area for 1 or 2 minutes, and then only stops because her phone rings If you look at the totality of those circumstances, you can still, not you can still, but that conduct is still indecent without that language. The gravamen of the offense does not change. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes.
Now, looking at, going back to the panel members, I think appellant, what he pointed out is that there was all this impeachment evidence. The defense brought out everything that they possibly could. They argued it in their closing. And those members took that information back there, and when they deliberated, what they came up with was what we had, a conviction that should be sustained for the three specifications. It's not a bad thing that the jury deliberated for such a long time, asked so many questions during the court-martial, and then came back with not guilty. In fact, that directly contradicts what the appellant argues in his brief, which is that the members were confused. Because certainly finding appellant not guilty of 5 out of the 8 specifications does not show that these members had any problems in deciding what they were going to convict on and what they were not going to convict on and what was justified in this case.
Speaking of not guilty findings, I was kind of intrigued by Prosecution 1, this alleged contract. And what is your view, and this is not a loaded question, I'm really interested in your view, and I'm sure Mr. Spinner might tell me his view if he wants to later. What is your view on the effect of the not guilty finding on the obstruction of justice, and what weight, if any, the members gave to the contract, which I believe was authenticated, or at least the foundation was laid, by Ms. Wilson, and appears to have two types of handwriting on it in two different colors of ink, initials, as she testified to. What is your view on how the members, or what impact their finding of not guilty on the obstruction charge has on the weight, if any, that should be given to this contract? Was that their finding a repudiation of Ms. Wilson's testimony concerning what this contract symbolized?
And that very well could be, Your Honor, but under U.S. v. Harris, the panel members can believe one part of her testimony and not the other, and that's totally justifiable. The government's position is that it corroborates what she says on why she recanted. Evidence in her testimony at record 470 to show that she was in dire straits after appellant got taken out of the house and these allegations were made. And she kept contact with him, good or bad. It's not our place to decide.
And she testified that she had him initial these various provisions, and then that's what was offered during her testimony, this Prosecution 1.
Right, and that is to also show that why she went and recanted. She recanted, and that's very important that the mother recanted and went and wrote this statement to the defense counsel, then turned around and got the contract that she was wanting because she was in such financial dire straits. But what's important about that is that ELC never recanted. The victim never recanted in this case. This was mom trying to get some kind of financial stability for her kids and get half of his retirement. It also corroborates the confession that he confessed to Miss Wilson not 24 hours after he talked to OSI. And that corroborates ELC's testimony. Mrs. Wilson testified that she had no knowledge of any details about the specifications. Nothing. She just knew that something had happened between her husband and her daughter. And that's evidenced by, as soon as she gets the call from the school, who does she call to go assist her daughter? Her husband, ELC's dad. And when he gets there, they don't let him have contact with her. Then after the allegations are made, Mrs. Wilson has a conversation with the appellant. And she describes it as emotional, crying, and when she asks him what happened, he in fact tells her, you know, I've been kissing her breast, I've been kissing her neck, and feeling on her vagina area. At this point, Ms. Wilson has nothing to base that, if it's truthful, except the appellant's admission. She does not know what her daughter has said. During ELC's testimony, it is brought out numerous times that Mom was never present during the interviews with OSI. In fact, she was only present at the Article 32 testimony preparation. And that's the first time that she actually heard the details of these allegations from her own daughter. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Sure. I was just curious as to what you thought about the contract as compared to the finding on obstruction of justice and how the two might relate as far as informing us of how we should view the contract, the alleged contract. This encounter with the accused, where you're talking about the admissions, was that the a subway parking lot encounter or something
yes,
else?
Yes, Your Honor.
No. And was that, it wasn't contemporaneous, obviously, but it was shortly after the OSI, on the way home from OSI?
Is yes,
that the
Your
one?
Honor.
Okay.
And I think it's the government's position that the contract corroborates what she's testifying about in at least the aspect of why she went and recanted. And the deal that she made with him in order to, I wouldn't even call recanted because she's not the one that made the allegation, but why she went in to try to have the charges dropped. Whether they found that was, you know, impeding an investigation, maybe it didn't look like that was enough, like maybe they were looking for him to forcibly stop her. That we don't know, whether or not guilty, but certainly she helped corroborate ELC's testimony about the actual sexual abuse that happened to her. Does that make sense, Your Honor? And going to the corroboration, let's talk about the corroboration that of ELC's testimony. Andrew Fisher was the friend that testified during the court-martial, and that was at record 427. And what he testified to is that it could have been maybe a couple weeks or 3 or 4 weeks before she comes and reports the allegation to Mrs. Cumberland, which is the guidance counselor, or it could have been the month before. That directly contradicts that Tina Wilson had anything to do with putting her daughter up to making false allegations. That corroborates ELC's testimony that she, in fact, did tell somebody else before she went to her guidance counselor. In fact, if you're 12 or 14 years old, it's not surprising that she said, my dad's filling me up, because she's not thinking of charges. Exactly what Your Honor pointed out, that was just one teenager talking to another. She wasn't thinking, let me spell out everything. And quite frankly, she is a 14-year-old child at this point and just trying to reach out to somebody. It just happens to be a friend at school. But it takes her a couple months, 3 weeks, as appellant tries to say, to think about what she's doing. And at that point, she's not happy at home. If you're a 14-year-old child being molested by your dad, are you going to be happy? And she certainly was very honest during the cross-examination that she was afraid to tell her mom because she didn't think her mom would believe her. So she goes to Mrs. Cumberland and she says, I'm not happy at home. Rightfully so. And she takes her some time, but she ends up telling Mrs. Cumberland what happened or what he was doing to her. Now, what's significant about that is that this is a defense witness. However, on cross-examination, she describes that after ELC reported it, that her whole demeanor changed during class. She was more She paid attention more. She talked more. She handed in her homework on time. Her whole demeanor, she came out of this fog, as Ms. Cumberland said. Why? Because now she's had the one thing that made her life a living hell removed from it. And that also backs up her testimony. And it might be noted that even though once the appellant was taken out of the house, this family, these three kids and Mrs. Wilson, were in financial dire straits. At one point, she says she couldn't buy a loaf of bread. But this little girl, ELC, is still a lot happier and feels a lot safer. The other thing is that when Mrs. Wilson recants or writes this statement saying that she put her daughter up to it, she directly goes to the commissary to meet ELC. She's going to talk to her about it. And there's a friend there that witnesses when Mrs. Wilson tells ELC, don't worry, you're not going to have to go to court. You're not going to have to talk about it anymore. You don't have to worry about anything. I'm going to take care of everything. And that was Tiffany English. And that's at record 470. Now, Tiffany English testified for the government because what she saw is that a distraught ELC. In fact, no matter what this little girl was going to have to be put through in order to have these charges or the appellant held accountable for these charges, she was willing to do that. She was very upset with her mother for going to the ADC's office and writing this statement. She wanted to hold the appellant accountable for what she did. And Tiffany English even testified that she was very emotional and she cried and she asked her mother, why would you do this? Why would you do this? The appellant may not want to acknowledge it, but that does corroborate ELC's testimony and also inadvertently bolsters her credibility without trying because of her reaction of what's going to happen if this agreement and this contract goes through. Appellant also argues about ELC being coached during her testimony. And that could be furthest from what the evidence of the record is. There's over 200 pages of her going through cross-examination and direct. And believe me, a 15-year-old girl doesn't remember everything. And apparently when there's been numerous instances of him grabbing her vagina and rubbing it at the computer, using her cell phone as means to let her, to have her walk over to him and have him touch her. This was not perfected testimony. And the defense brought that out. They talked about the lack of detail during her OSI statement. And she tells them right up front at page 213, look, I didn't know these people. I didn't feel comfortable. I just wanted to tell them what I had to tell them and leave. She was upset. She was crying. And common sense in ways the world can... people are not going to spill their guts, and certainly not some 14-year-old, to strangers, every single detail, the first time that they admit what's happening to them. I don't even think an adult, under the stress of that event, just being interviewed by somebody for the first time about sexual abuse of any type would be like, okay, I have every detail down. But if she was coached, if she was prepared for that, that OSI interview would have been a lot different. The Article 32 testimony would have been totally different, and so would her testimony at that court-martial. There wouldn't be 100 pages of cross-examination. But they had that. They had that opportunity. And the most important thing is so do those members have that opportunity and ask those questions and listened and watched ELC testify. It's also notable that out of 100 pages or so of direct examination, when appellant argues that there were leading questions, there was almost 300 questions by the government. How many objections? One. But now they want this court to consider that there were leading questions. Certainly, asking questions of a 15-year-old is totally different than asking questions of an OSI agent that's been on the stand for seven times, or a 21-year-old that has a lot more ability to express themselves. But only one objection during that entire testimony by the defense about leading questions, and it was overruled. And I think the coaching goes along with the inconsistencies, because the government's position is if you have all these inconsistencies, then how can you say she was coached? That directly contradicts any kind of logic that didn't provide any testimony that she was coached. And in her inconsistencies, that goes around along with normal human recollection of memory over time. Some of these things happened to her when she was 12 years old, and she was 15 when she was talking about them. And she told the members during the court-martial that she wanted to forget this. She spent time actually just trying to get it out of her mind. She didn't want to remember these things anymore. And she was also questioned extensively about who she had talked to and what they had told her to say. And she told them, "Nobody told me anything, ever." And that was at Record 360. Nobody has said, OSI hasn't told me to say anything, my mom hasn't told me to say anything, nobody. And the defense used that in their argument, that she had been coached, and it was up to those members to decide on that credibility. Now, just to reiterate with Specification 5, just to have it noted that when the government's case rested, there was no RCM 917 motion at the time for this offense, and the military judge did not sua sponte feel like evidence had not been presented. And certainly under U.S. v. Hong, you can extract or accept the language in touching her legs, and the gravamen of the offense still stays the same. In his intent, an indecent act actually still stays the same. When you read her testimony and look at the totality of the circumstances of what he did that day and what they heard, that he was standing behind her and just pulled down her pants and underwear, not to mention the fact by this time this was a regular thing for them. This was his MO. This is how he operated. He walked up behind her, pulled down her pants and underwear, and then started rubbing her pubic area for 1 to 2 minutes. That act is still indecent. And that was with the intent to gratify his sexual desires under the totality of the circumstances. And if your honors have no more questions, I will conclude.
You may.
Contrary to appellant's claims, the victim's testimony was corroborated by witness testimony that these allegations were true, beyond a reasonable doubt, and she was not coached in any way, shape, or form, and that the way that she testified was how a 15-year-old girl who had been molested by her own dad numerous times would recollect and have the memory that she had. And after 7.5 hours of testimony for a 15-year-old and 10 hours of jury deliberations, 25 questions by the panel members, this court should affirm, modify the findings with respect to Specification 5, reassess the sentence exactly what the members adjudged, and affirm this conviction.
Thank you. Mr. Spinner?
Thank you.
I'd like to pick up right with one of the last statements made by government counsel where she talked about M.O. The problem is it M.O. or is it something else? Is it her just telling the same story over and over again, same details but different settings, because it's easy for her to do that? The problem is, the government argues when she says this, that shows Sergeant Wilson's M.O. I would argue that on the contrary, it shows that she has just taken one particular type of behavior and she has repeated it and dressed it up in different situations over a period of time. So it just shows her creativity. And this goes back to when you read the cross-examination of the complainant, what you see is that she has memory problems and that she has inconsistencies. And there's a lack of detail in the original report. And the government even tries to pin her down on that. And so right now what I want to do is break out each of the three specifications of which he was convicted and address each of those three specifically in terms of impeachment and the problems with them. The specification with respect to the shower. And basically, all that specification is saying is that in 2005, some years prior to this trial and prior to the claim of report, she's saying he touched her on the leg in the shower. That's it. He touched her on the leg in the shower. Now, you have to believe that she's being truthful and that she's credible because of her, because she can remember, describe, recall, etc., and that she doesn't have any motive to misrepresent when she has come up with this. But the point is, that kind of detail is really not provided anywhere. Except then when she testifies at court, she says, she now adds a detail that did not appear previously. And that concerns hair clippers. She says, oh, he was coming in to get hair clippers, even though she had testified, I think, at the Article 32 that he just came in to get something, but she could not recall what it was that he came in to get. So now, at court, for the first time, she's adding detail. And the kind of detail that was denied previously. And I made a note, because in my brief, I wrote down that she was confronted on page 260 by the defense counsel on that point, but the it's page 188, which is not in my brief, where she says that hair clippers, he was looking for hair clippers. And I submit that on this kind of fact, I mean, how does a man defend himself when a woman says, 2 years ago, while I was in the shower, you came in and you touched my leg?
Isn't there a little bit more to the story than that?
There really wasn't much.
Didn't he come in, get the clippers, she got out of the shower, and said, what are you doing here? Grabbed the clippers, left, and then he came back.
Well, right. Okay. Except the hair clippers don't appear in her story until trial.
But don't details typically, no matter what kind of case it is, show up at trial that weren't there because they've been questioned differently or have reflected
right.
on
and
the situation?
And I maintain that those details show up either through suggestion in preparation for trial, or because the complainant or a complainant is trying to add or embellish details because they don't feel that they've had enough. And it's that willingness to embellish and add details that shows you can't be confident in the original claim or story to begin
with. So you said that there's no way that because a person has been reflecting on it that they might remember more than they did originally when they made the complaint or when they were...
No, not saying that.
Okay.
I'm not saying there's no way.
Okay, I'm just curious.
But if she's going to embellish, I mean, why not just go whole hog? Forget the hair clippers.
Well,
let's just embellish the heck out of touching my leg.
Well,
I mean, why stop there if you're embellishing?
Well, point well taken. The point is, how do you know when she's embellishing and when she isn't? And see, you have to know beyond a reasonable doubt when she's embellishing and she isn't. It's just a matter of issue. We can speculate all day whether she's speculating or not. The question is, has the government proved beyond a reasonable doubt that she's not just coming up with this as a fabrication?
But rare is the case, especially a sex case, where you don't have this kind of stuff.
That is true.
I guess I'm asking, where do you think a fact finder, or for that matter, an appellate court, draws the line between the normal run-of-the-mill, and I don't mean that to say these make light of the charges, but run-of-the-mill in the sense that it happens about all the time, that you've got inconsistencies and details that come out one time and not another. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that the proof fails.
No, but it doesn't mean the proof succeeds either.
Well, right. Right. That's why we have court members.
Right, but court members, nor are you, human lie detector. And that's the problem, is you become, as a court member, a human lie detector when you say, just based on her testimony alone, I believe what she said beyond a reasonable doubt. You're saying she's telling the truth beyond a reasonable doubt.
You got to make the call, yeah.
Right, and maybe this is just a generic problem that I have with all sex offense cases, is that I believe there are innocent men sitting in prisons across America, more likely in the military than outside the military, based on my humble experience, where it was just this sort of statement of memory. 2 years ago, he touched me in the shower, and all, you know, there's a few more details there. But what we have here is a progression. We have a progression from the statement to the OSI, which is almost totally lacking in detail. When you compare that statement against the actual offenses of which he's convicted, there's practically a total lack of detail. And then, to the extent that there is some detail, it's inaccurate. So I start with what I consider the least serious specification of which he was convicted, touching her leg in the shower. It was 2 years old, and I mean, I just can't think of any way that a man can defend himself against that charge. And so I'm asking the court to look at this with some degree of skepticism as to whether it meets the standard. And only you can decide whether it meets that standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you start talking about her demeanor on the stand, well, they acquitted her of other things, and they saw her demeanor on the stand. So demeanor must not have been a big factor in their decision to know when to convict and when to acquit. So let me go back to the skipping the specification 5, which has to do with the legs. I mean, I submit that the gravamen of that offense is that he touched, that the allegation, and the government drafted that specification that he touched her legs, and she said, no, he didn't touch my legs. Now, did she tell them in their private interviews, he touched my legs, and that's why the specification appears that way? I can only speculate that that's why the government drafted the specification that way, because that's what they told her. That's what she told them, I'm sorry. And yet she comes into court, and much to the prosecutor's surprise, no doubt, she says, he didn't touch my legs. And so I'm saying that's the gravamen of the offense. If it was an attempt, then it should have been charged as like an attempt in charge 1, which was charged as an attempt. Finally, with respect to the last specification, here's the reason why it fails. What I see is the key reason why it fails. She does walk into the OSI on the 28th or 29th of January of 2008, and she says, the last time this happened was Saturday when I wanted to get on the computer. Well, now, the defense counsel asked her, when's your memory best, when you make the statement or today? She says, well, at least an objective person would say, well, my memory's best, if this occurred on Saturday, my memory's best now about what occurred on Saturday. But in trial, that turned into, it occurred in October. It occurred in October. If you look at pages, I think it's 253 and 255 in the record of trial and cross-examination, that's where that point is developed and made. That hey, wait a minute. Oh, and guess what else she changed? It was on Sunday, not Saturday. See, in the statement she says it's Saturday. But then, again, I can speculate only to some degree that she realized that when she went back to October in that time frame, her mom was home on Saturdays. And since her mom couldn't have been home when this happened, it had to happen on Sunday. So see how, on this specification, the story has changed. It changed from being Saturday to being months ago. It changed from being Saturday to being Sunday. And now the government wants you to say, believe her beyond a reasonable doubt, that it occurred when it occurred, even though she can't even get those kinds of details, tell a consistent story in those kinds of details. You see, a lot of the rest of this is really fluff. I mean, the fact is, you have to sit down and look at each of the three specifications of which he was convicted. You have to look at the evidence that supports that specification. And then, I see my time is up, so if I may conclude my sentence.
You may.
And then you have to decide. I mean, this is a matter of conscience for the court. You have to be satisfied that he is guilty of these offenses factually beyond reasonable doubt. And so I'm the last one to preach to this court. It's for you to ultimately draw that conclusion on your own. And I think that the conclusion is that this conviction should not be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spinner. Thank you for those arguments. We will take this case under consideration and render our opinion in due course. Court is adjourned.